Madam Secretary, can we call the roll?
Here.
Here. Okay. If we could kind of quiet it down in the auditorium, we're going to start our meeting now. Thank you all. First of all, I want to thank Director Najarian for chairing the committee last time around. I had some out-of-town business, and I want to let you know that he takes credit for all the good stuff, and all the bad stuff falls on my plate.
I like that. I like that deal, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Matsumoto.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee. This month's oral report will be provided by Assistant Treasurer Mike Smith. Donna Mills is out this week.
Good afternoon. The presentation this month is intended to focus on the current macroeconomic indicators and consider events that could affect the outlook for Metro. GDP is expected to grow at a rate of about 2 to 2.5% in 2012, consistent with the outlook of many economists who indicate the domestic recovery is likely still a multi-year work in progress. The projected 2% GDP growth is too weak to materially reduce unemployment in the short run. Recent downward movement in national unemployment is expected to continue, but forecasts predict the rate may still be around 8% by year end. Inflation is likely to be constrained by continuing high unemployment and weak consumption. The consensus forecast for the consumer price index is 2 to 2.4%, while core CPI, which excludes volatile food and energy components, is expected to increase 1.6%, which remains below the Fed's 2% threshold. At last month's meeting, the Fed, they announced their intention to keep short-term rates exceptionally low through at least mid-2013 and possibly into 2014 in order to stimulate economic growth. You can see the rates have been quite low since 2009. Rates in the intermediate to long end of the Treasury yield curve are forecast to be in the 2 to 2.5% range, only slightly higher than their record lows seen in the fourth quarter of 2011. These expectations are driven by the Fed's low rates policy and the U.S. Treasury bonds retaining their status as a safe haven for investors as the European sovereign debt banking crisis keeps investors and markets nervous. Risks to the global and domestic economy recoveries could result from significant problems with European banks and financial markets that would likely result from problems with European sovereign debt and could lead to significant tightening of U.S. domestic credit conditions and slow or stall the U.S. recovery. Also, deleveraging of the world's developing economies will be a long-term process that will limit consumption expenditures and tend to slow the economic recovery for a while. Specific points of competing partisan political agendas may have impacts on banking, business development, and consumer spending in the next year. Excess housing inventories and low market values will continue to be a drag on the economic growth. Various pension reform proposals in play at the state level could result in significant retirements, draining institutional knowledge, and reducing productivity in governments. Recent increases in sales tax receipts may be at risk if consumers reduce spending due to concerns in the economy. The economy is taking a negative turn. Increasingly, the lower interest rates, though, are providing additional opportunities to refund additional bonds for interest cost savings. Fiscal year to date through December, total fare revenue was 2.2% below prior fiscal year revenue. Conversely, monthly boardings are slightly ahead of prior year actuals. This bar graph shows MTA employees by category and indicates the percentage currently eligible to retire. The corresponding numerical values are provided in the table. Pension reform proposals being considered by a state legislature and perhaps more so by proposed voter initiatives could prompt unknown numbers of employees to retire in order to maintain current benefit levels. This graph provides an indication of how our borrowing costs are continuing to decline, making additional bond fundings beneficial to us. And since our last update, we've evaluated competing strategies proposed by our bond underwriters, but are still seeking additional information prior to making a recommendation. And we've completed negotiations and documentation for replacement of liquidity that will occur this month and, in fact, next week. We executed two collateral agreements related to our defeased leases, resolving two additional AIG-related defaults. Of the initial seven AIG-related defaults, only two remain. A collateral agreement was executed with Merrill Lynch to post collateral to us related to a $16 million investment agreement. And during the past month, we participated in a presentation to the U.S. DOT in Washington, D.C. as part of the application process for the Crenshaw Project's $546 million TIFIA loan. We've subsequently participated in follow-up to that meeting as well. As next steps, we'll complete the $166 million liquidity replacement next week. In April, we'll request the Measure R Oversight Committee to make a finding of benefit related to the Crenshaw TIFIA borrowing. And we'll continue to work with DOT to finalize their credit analysis for the Crenshaw TIFIA loan project. That's the end of the report. Thank you.
Thank you. Can board members, do you have any questions?
I have a question, Mr. Chair. We had this same anomaly when we looked at Metrolink's numbers. Ridership up, but revenue down. We really didn't have a clear answer for that. Understandably, different types of transit, but do we have an explanation for that? How can that be?
We can. The board approved several changes in our fares. We reduced the cost of the day pass from $6 to $5 last August, obviously making that an attractive fare media to buy. We also introduced rolling 30 and 7-day passes, replacing period passes, which were monthly and weekly, as you recall. It is possible, you know, as we, one of the risks of going to the rolling, the advantage to the consumer is that they don't have to buy a new pass just because it's the end of the month. They can buy their passes whenever they need to. And so, for example, say the Christmas period at the end of December, if they knew that they were going to take 2 weeks off, they wouldn't need to buy a whole December pass. They would perhaps buy two weeklies and then wait until they actually come back to work and buy another 30-day pass. So we think that the consumers have benefited from that, as resulting in slightly increased ridership, but revenues are down.
Okay. Fasano? Question? Okay, I have a couple questions. Can you roll back on your presentation to the sales forecast, please?
I don't think we had a sales tax per se forecast page.
We don't?
No, not in this month. We only do that quarterly.
Pardon?
We only do a sales tax update quarterly. The monthly intervening, other than the month end, quarter ends, the state board procedures are not meaningful in terms of doing any kind of analysis. So it's at the end of a quarter, then it makes meaningful decisions as the state board does.
So when we get that from the State Board of Equalization, or is that from a different agency?
State Board of Equalization sends us money monthly, but they do a quarterly reconciliation on the quarter month end.
And when are their quarters in? Is it fiscal year? Is it calendar year?
They're calendar quarters. So last month in our January report, we did report on the quarter ended December.
And the numbers that they sent you for December, is it actual December numbers or is it numbers from previous months?
It's really reflective of the prior quarter's economic activity.
Right. In September. You know, it seems to me that as an agency that is heavily reliant on sales tax, and I think we are, Measure R, Prop A, Prop C. It seems to me that we want to be a little bit closer to what is actually happening in the real world, particularly in light of the fact that we have certain projects here that we're hoping that we can get built out, i.e., you know, the additional work on the Crenshaw line and some of the other lines that we're working on. I would like to have a closer look, a more frequent look, I would say, not closer, of how the sales tax revenue is and where does it look. Because if we're dealing with every quarter, and in the report that we had in the last quarter was not even inclusive of December of 2011, correct?
Correct.
So actually our information is we're really lagging way behind. And I think it makes it easier for me as a policymaker and thinking about what our anticipated revenue might be. It would make it better for me to have that information sooner than later instead of waiting. So is there a way for you to package this so that we can have more regular updates on the sales tax revenue, you know, and it could be, you know, reconciled by the Board of Equalization or unreconciled. You could just state as a condition of your report, this is unreconciled or this is reconciled. So I think we all can understand that. But what type of systems can we put in to measure that and give us more accurate updates on the revenue coming in from sales taxes?
The State Board is our primary source. It's actually the source for all of our professional outside consultants, UCLA, Muni Services, and the like. And the State Board process is for large taxpayers have to remit estimated amounts to the state every month. Small taxpayers only submit their tax returns at the end of the quarter. So, for example, for sales during the month of September would be recorded in the September quarterly report for them. However, by the time the state gets around to processing it, it isn't known until December. So the lag is really the state processing that. I don't know how we could shortcut that any closer. There are national statistics that come out on retail sales, as you probably are aware, but we don't have any L.A. County-specific monthly reporting of retail sales.
So we're into February at this time, and so I don't expect you to have January yet. But isn't it reasonable to think that you could have December's receipts by now?
We did get the December receipts. But as you noted before, it's the State Board is really only reconciling the September quarterlies at that point.
Right.
So the short answer is, no, we're not in a position to intercept the actual flow of information between retailers to the state.
So you're saying that the December numbers are not in yet? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
And so when would that... those numbers being, I'm not talking about the whole quarter, I'm just talking about on the month, not the quarter, but the month of December.
The month of December's activity will be reconciled in the March payments.
So if I don't want to put words in your mouth, what you're saying is that the only way we can get information is on a quarterly basis.
That's the only meaningful information, yes.
When you say meaningful, what does that mean?
They send us money each month, but it's really a formula-based allocation based on the same month the prior year, adjusted for State Board estimates of growth or decline.
Okay, but they square up. Maybe I'm asking the wrong question then. So they send the money each month, but they send us a report each quarter.
No, they send us – correct. We only get a reconciliation each quarter. We get money every month.
Right. And the money that they send us each month, we know what it is, correct?
Yes.
And we deposit it somewhere. We do something with that money.
Yes, I can certainly right. We can certainly provide that if you
yeah,
like.
That's that I'm trying to figure out, you know, I'm not trying to complicate, you know, this whole process. I'm just trying to get more information sooner. And we all have the ability to look at if it's unreconciled. Is there any instances where the state will say, we gave you too much money, MTA, we're taking some back, or we're offsetting it in the next period that we give you money?
Isn't that ever happen?
That happens from time to time, yes.
That does happen where they say they gave you too much?
Yes.
Is that more of an aberration or more of the norm?
I would say we probably get one or two notices of take-backs in a year.
Yeah. Then, Mr. Fasano, I'm going to follow up, but I don't want to cut you off. I think you were saying something.
Yeah, I was just suggesting that I think some of the payments are kind of advanced payments, and they true it up, what, every quarter? Or?
That's correct. That's the method. So that the intermediate months, for example, the January payments and the February payments, are formula based on the state's receipts a year ago in those 2 months.
Yeah. And who's the cash flow manager for this agency?
I am.
Okay. And so you are accustomed to getting receipts, and you are accustomed to taking those dollars with the investment strategy that we have, and you're putting it wherever, you know, you deem is the best place given our policy, right?
Correct.
So you have a track record. How many years have you been here?
Just about 20.
In this position?
Pretty much.
So I think you have a pretty good institutional history, right?
Right.
Okay. So it just what I'm asking, Mr. Matsumoto, really is that we could get more information sooner. And, you know, if I think you have the capacity to do it. I don't know what systems you use, but it seems to me that just based on the fact that over the last 20 years, every month we get money. And you can, you know, you do on these other charts, you compare that to previous years, you compare it to previous months. And I think it would just make it easier for me as a person who sits on this committee to have a clearer picture of, well, what does our cash flow picture really look like? Is it comparable to a month ago? Is it comparable to a year ago, the same month? Is it comparable to 3 years ago? And I think that would help me understand more clearly what our revenue picture will look like instead of waiting and always having the lag. I understand that there's a lag, and that's a part of the function of the state. But there is something that we control, and that is we control that the fact that we acknowledge that we receive those dollars and we put those dollars somewhere. So what I'm asking you to do is I don't know the systems that you use, but you're pretty smart, and your staff, they're pretty smart too. I think you guys can come up with a system. And could you just next month, if you can get back to me or with – Director, we have
no problem with the caveats that you acknowledged.
Right.
We have no problem showing month to month.
And then you can always put like the CPAs do. They put their disclaimer up here. You know, I understand all that piece.
Okay.
But I'm just trying to figure out how can we get, you know, more information. And it's up to us to make the judgment as to is this real? Is it, you know, is this likely to happen again or did it happen in the past? I think we can make those kind of judgments. But for you to put it up, I think it makes it easier for us, at least for me.
Okay. Not a problem.
Thank you. Mr. Najarian, everybody else? Okay, can we move on then to the pension part?
Yes.
Go ahead. There's a pension. No, you on your graph, you showed a pension report, and I thank you, Mr. Matsumoto. We talked about this. At least I spoke about this to Mr. Leahy. One of the concerns that I have is that we have a number of folks who've been with our agency. They have a lot of knowledge. And my concern is that as forces happen outside of our control, that some of them may opt to take an early retirement, get out of here, because if there's laws that are changing, is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah. So it would be really a severe drain on our brain power and institutional knowledge if all of a sudden folks decided, I've been here 20 years, I'm 55 or older, and I don't want them to take a hit on my pension fund, so I'm getting out now. And so I thank you for putting this on here because hopefully it'll help us prepare for an exodus that could or could not happen. But at least if it doesn't happen, we're okay. If it does happen, at least we'll have some kind of a plan, an organized plan. So is that something that you do, or is that the CEO who works on those kinds of strategies?
Well, there are two issues, and I'll let Paul comment on the CEO strategy. On our side, I manage the pension plans, and we keep track of these things, and also responsible for doing the analysis of pending legislation that may affect us in the pension area. As recently announced by the governor's office, he presented bill language fleshing out his 12-point plan that he announced last fall. Of those 12 provisions, points, one of them affects the most dramatic effect on current employees is the requirement that statewide any public sector employee must pay at least 50% of the pension costs.
How much?
50% of the annual pension costs.
And how does that compare to today?
For us in non-contract, the organization pays 100% now, so that's a pretty good size hit to employee salaries.
And if that goes through, and the employees who are vested now are basically required to adhere to this new legislation or guideline or whatever it is that the governor is proposing, then that means that those folks who are currently receiving a pension contribution at 100% level from us will now all of a sudden have to come out of their own pocket for the other. That's a huge hit.
Indeed. Let me give you a for example. In the non-contract bar, we are in the PERS program. This year's annual cost is approximately 15% of payroll. So if that were to pass, that's 7.5% that the employee would have to pay out of his net check. So it's perhaps greater than 7.5% of his take-home.
So if we're talking of an average staff that earns, let's say company-wide or agency-wide, perhaps it's $65,000. So now they have to come up with $5,000 out of their pocket to pay their pension fund.
Yes.
That's a huge incentive to get out, wouldn't it?
To various folks, yes. No question about it.
Yeah. Okay. So do these numbers that I'm looking at here for employee retirement, UTU, ATU, TCU, and the like, do you know how many, what the percentage is? And if you don't know it now, that's okay. You can get back with me on it. What the number or percentage of folks that we have that are in that category where they've been here long enough to be eligible to take an opt-out, and they're old enough to meet that threshold so that we can kind of figure out how many people really may be having to make a tough decision?
Well, the second line from the bottom there, eligible to retire, those are the actual numbers of employees who qualify for retirement as of the end of December. Now, it would be a matter of individual choice, I'm sure the board
that's
recognizes.
That's almost 2,000 employees.
And
who meet the criteria that you just outlined.
And that's huge.
It's enormous. And
that's huge.
Mr. Chairman, to the other part of your question, we see this as a serious challenge. And while we have been thinking all along that within 5 years, if not 1 year, we would be facing this challenge, we realize now that it's much more upon us, and we're going to be taking some serious actions in the very near future. We'll be reporting to the committee on what those are to get ahead of this challenge.
That's nearly what 20%, 18%
of our
workforce, right?
It is.
That's correct.
And of those, I would imagine that a lot of them are at the upper end of the tenure here in terms of the number of years, which most likely means that they are in upper management, a lot of brain power, a lot of institutional knowledge. And I think that could really hurt us.
You've said it very well.
Yes.
So we're taking it very seriously, and we're making dramatic plans to deal with this.
Thank you, Mr. I'm glad to hear that, Ms. Taylor.
These are people who each of our union and the non-represented have a different retirement program in terms of eligibility. But generally speaking, it's people who've been here more than 20 years and are over 55.
Is that what we do? We allow them to retire after 55?
Each one is different, but
is
for instance, for the four unions there, that's been negotiated. For the non-represented employees, it's PERS, and I believe, Terry, it's what, 60?
The minimum is 5 years, age 50. So the...
This has been a negotiated contract, and I know I sat through those things, and it's never, ever been pointed out to me.
No, this is the PERS. PERS is take it or leave it. Yeah.
Your mic.
It's 55. It's never been mentioned in a union negotiation. How long has it been on the books? Does anyone know?
The governor announced his
12-point. Terry, the director's speaking about the when were these retirement provisions negotiated with the unions, and I think it's over time. The UTU is probably the longest standing.
I believe that the bulk of what you're looking at here was done in the late 80s.
Yeah.
Under the RTD.
Age 55 retirement?
If you want to go into the unions, it's 23 years of service at any age.
UTU?
UTU, ATU, and TCU have those provisions. And they get 50% pay at any age.
So that's how it stands on that? That it's just 23 years of service no matter what age?
There are prorate provisions for each year of service and each age.
No, I understand how pensions work. That's not what I'm asking.
Yes.
So as long as you have 23 years of service, you can retire whenever you compile your 23.
Correct.
That's for all of them or just UTU?
UTU, ATU, and TCU have very similar provisions. That provision, 23 years of service at any age.
Those are what we call those the legacy provisions from the RTD.
Correct.
Those are the unions that represented the RTD rank and file for decades.
Mr. Matsumoto, this proposal that the governor is outlining, is it something that he's asking someone in the legislature to introduce, or is it a policy that he can do unilaterally?
I'm not quite up on the specific requirements, but I believe that the governor has introduced it to the legislature.
And do you know if is anyone from the legislative team here from the state?
No. We can get back to you on more.
Okay.
Yeah.
More about all right. That. It just seems like it's a lot closer than we thought.
Yes, and I would also note, as Mike indicated, we are aware of several initiatives seeking to do that, and we don't have a clear look on that as to whether those will achieve the appropriate level of signatures to get them on the ballot.
Yeah. Well, is this a ballot measure or something that the legislature would do?
The governor has proposed his bill to be going out for a vote in the November election. Yeah. The initiatives that are circulating, of course, would bypass the legislative process, but are targeted for the November election.
So it's really imminent, isn't it?
I expect at least one, if not a handful, of these will get onto the November ballot.
Well, just looking at how the governor has proposed dealing with the budget shortfalls, a number of cities all throughout the state have now had to grapple with the fact that their CRA projects and that whole CRA way of doing things is going to be defunct. And so I think the governor has used his experience in bully pulpit, and I'm not saying this is bad or good. I'm just saying this is what he's done in practice. And so if he's proposing something like this, and if the public gets behind it, given that, everybody is concerned about overspending and, pension plans that are out of control. I'm not saying that ours is. I'm just saying that this is what people are hearing. This may become a reality sooner than later. And so I'm going to ask my colleagues on the board. I don't know if you guys see it as a serious item as I do. Mr. Fasano?
I think this is a lot more than the governor. I think there's a lot of people that are interested in looking at this whole thing. I guess one of the other things I'm hearing where there's still some risk and some analysis is whether they can claw back and change the requirements on existing plans that have already been provided. So I think that's still one of the legal challenges that is out there. It seems that changes for future employees are easier to make, but there's some question in terms of constitutional protections for existing plans. And
that's true. Generally, even the state legislative analysts acknowledge that going retroactive on somebody's benefits already earned and trying to reduce them might quite be unconstitutional in the state. However, the initiatives may not be cognizant of that, nor would they really care. So there's no requirement that those initiatives actually be legally sound. But clearly, for new employees, virtually anything is possible.
I believe the CEO wants to comment on this, and then I'm going to ask for my colleagues to help me with a motion so we can kind of make this a higher priority item for our agency. Go ahead, Mr. Leahy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate making it a higher priority. I wanted just to let you know we've been working on some conceptual approaches to a large problem, which includes this one. We've been talking for some time about preparing for the problem of the baby boomers leaving the MTA, which they're going to do one way or the other. We face a profound generational transition as baby boomers retire, do whatever. So that's a problem. This issue with pensions could accelerate to crisis level the problem of people retiring and could do so potentially in fairly short order. Add to that that we face a situation in which we have equipment, rolling stock, buses and trains, and facilities which are increasingly complex and increasingly reliable, reliant upon high technology applications, fare systems, radios, equipment, and the like, means that we have a big challenge in ensuring that we have a workforce that can maintain this system. Add to that an opportunity. The military is downsizing. We are removing folks, thank God, from some of the combat situations that they face. And so it occurs to us that having an office which works on the development of the next generation, the development of people who can move up in the organization, and who can conduct an effective and strong outreach effort to those who are retiring from one of the branches of the armed services to recruit people to come in with the MTA presents a big opportunity. So we'll be looking to making that assignment to one of our top-level people in the coming weeks. And it ties right in, Mr. Wilson, to this problem that the committee is discussing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. CEO. Here's what I'm asking my colleagues to help me out with. I don't really have the solution, but I just think that, you know, we have a duty to, think ahead. This is something that is likely to happen. I'd like to have a motion where, one, we would instruct the CEO and the – what is your title, Mr. Matsuda?
Chief Financial Services Officer.
The guys with the – manages our big bucks, we'll call you. Chief Financial Officer to come back to this committee next month with a report, and the report should talk about, one, the approximate number of folks who are eligible, as you have in your PowerPoint presentation here, to where they sit in terms of our management scheme of the various departments that we have in this agency, so we can see if that were to happen, how many would impact operations, how many would impact procurement and planning and all these other different areas that we have. The level of years that we have for those who are not in that eligible category that we could start looking at as moving up the ladder, or should we have to go out to a wider search. So I think that needs to be a part of it. The other part, I believe, needs to be a legislative part, and that is we need to have our legislative team coordinate with the board members here. Many of them are well connected up and down the state, and see how realistic this is so that we can at least begin to talk to Ms. Molina's former colleagues in the Assembly and others who have served, and their former board members who may be in the Assembly now or other parts of the government. Mr. Katz, I know they all have good relationships, but so I think we need to have a legislative component of this too, so that we can at least get a feel for how realistic this is and begin the plan. And then lastly, I think we need to have a plan of, if this were to happen, what are we going to do in a way that's thoughtful and that will be the least amount of harm to this agency to carry on this mission. So that's what I'm asking my colleagues to do is to work. Mr. Fasana?
I think there's a lot of public support for doing something given what's been happening in the private sector and what's happened in the public sector. If we are unable to come to grips with this, I could actually envision where some of these employees faced with a 50% contribution might be more than willing to work. If we were unable to proceed, we may need to still keep them on, provide additional salary to offset their additional contributions, which would affect their salary and their final formula when they did leave. So it could have all sorts of unintended consequences during a transition, which probably to some extent are inevitable whenever you make a change of this type. So planning ahead is a good idea.
Yeah, I think so. And Mr. Fasano, I know in the city of Los Angeles they have a program that the firefighters and the police officers are take part in. It's called the DROP program, where they freeze their pensions for 5 years, and their salaries or continue on, and then they get a buyout after a period of time. All those are options, and Mr. Leahy expressed another opportunity. And so I'm not saying all this is bad. I'm just saying it's going to be a shock to our system, and that is we could perhaps, the university that we have, we can start training folks to come into this agency to start, taking on additional responsibility. But what I think we really need is something that's well thought out. So can I ask one of you, Ms. Molina, Mr. Fasana, Mr. Najarian, if you would help me in instructing our staff to, one, come back with a plan, looking at the number of employees that we have that are eligible, looking at the number that are ones that are in the management positions and, agency-wide, so we'll see where the hit may take us. I'm just looking around this room here, and I see a couple folks who are friends of mine who happen to be in these high positions, and they're very smart, and I think they're smart enough to get out and freeze their pension at the high level if they can and come back as a private sector person, and contract with us or with other agencies and make a lot more money than they're making now. I just think that this is a realistic thing that may occur. So what do we need a motion for that, Mr. CEO?
What you're saying is exactly resonates with the sorts of concerns that we've had. You've added some dimensions. We'd be pleased to come back in March. If you want to pass a resolution, that's fine. That would be fine. But this is a crisis problem we need to confront, as you outlined it.
Thank you.
But I don't. I appreciate what our chair is saying, but I'm not so sure what you're doing. Can you clarify what you would be bringing back in March?
We'll come back with some data.
Data.
As I said, we'll come back with some data that breaks down by unit how many employees there are, which of them are eligible for retirement, what order of magnitude of problem do we have. Where might replacement employees come from? Are there people within the organization from whom we might draw, or is the number too big? Of course, we need to look at what the provisions of such a law might be, whether we can have someone in that situation retire and come back. But we'll go back, we'll make a transcript of the chair's comments, and we'll try to put together a board report working with HR as well that tries to respond to the specific things that he's outlined.
Is that?
Yeah, do I need to? Let me just take the liberty as a discretion of the chair and just make a motion and ask for somebody to second it. And believe me, I'm not the expert in this. I'm just trying to. I'm a person who is a common sense, and I'm just trying to figure out how to get ahead of this before it becomes a major problem. I know the CEO has already thought about this, but I want it to become a higher priority for this agency. So I'm going to move that we instruct the CEO and the CFO and whatever other departments. Mr. CEO, you have the discretion. You know who your management team is, to come back next month at the Finance Budget and Audit Committee with, one, the number of folks who are eligible, two, how many they are in the various departments, so break it down by departments, three, that we would engage our legislative team to start working to make this a higher priority at the state level, and to brief our board members so that they can use the relationships that they have with folks that are in the legislature, and then to have a plan of action in the event that folks do decide to exit us out of here, that we'll have a thoughtful way to carry on the mission of this agency.
I'll second the motion.
Thank you.
I just want to follow
up. Add something? Go ahead.
You know, in terms of the legislative side, I'm not sure this is something we necessarily want to oppose. There might be nuances in terms of...
Well, I'm not saying oppose it. We need to be aware of it.
Right, and if there are certain nuances where we might have input that would be beneficial to the public.
Yeah. No, I'm not saying this is good or bad. I'm just saying it's a reality that these things may happen, and I'd rather know what the legislature is thinking and saying before they actually pass it.
Okay.
That's where I'm coming from. It's not taking one side or other, because there are some good that could come out of this. As Mr. Leahy has said, there are a lot of folks who are coming back. They're unemployed. We have this university that we started not too long ago. We could start ratcheting that up. There are a lot of goods that can come out of it, but at the same time, it's going to take a long time to replace the brain power that we have. I look at Ms. Caldwell, I look at Mr. Matsumoto, I look at Ms. Holden, I look at all these folks, Ms. Soto, who've been around here a long time. These are smart people, and it's going to be hard to replace them overnight. And so we need to have a thoughtful way of looking at that.
Sure.
And that includes you, too. You may decide to go, too.
May
so
I?
That's a motion. It's a second it.
Second.
Okay, is there any, Mr. Matsumoto, you want to chime in?
May I ask for to come back in April, because our board report cycle would have us do the report this Friday, and
sure.
I'm sure you want
I do. I want it thoughtful. So,
Can I maybe just fit in here? We can come back to the committee with some charts, not narrative, by the next committee meeting. I agree, we don't have time to do detailed analyses and narrative and program development, but we can begin to get a handle on the magnitude of the problem and where the problem lies at your next meeting.
Okay.
Gary?
Right.
Thank you. If you don't have it all together, Madam Secretary, or your staff, I'll certainly let you know after the meeting. I can show you. But you got it all. Whoa, that's good. See, we may lose you, too. Well, you're not that old yet, right? Okay, there's a motion, and there's a second. Is there any further discussion on this item? Okay, hearing none, without objection, so ordered. Thank you, Mr. Matsumoto and your team. Can you reintroduce your team again? I've forgotten your names. I just want to acknowledge your good work.
This is Mike Smith, Assistant Treasurer. And Marsha Liu, Principal Financial Analyst.
Hello, Mr. Smith. Thank you both for your excellent work. And tell Ms. Mills, I think it is, that we missed her.
Yes.
Okay. Next item.
Good afternoon, Directors. Item 16 is for approval of a contract award for the Contract Information Management System. This off-the-shelf system will allow the procurement department to move from our current paper-intense file creation system to a paperless system. The desire to move to an automated system has been contemplated by this agency for several years. In fact, prior to the passage of Measure R, the vision for what we call SIMS was that it would be solely for the use by the contract administrators. And that was what we had approved by the board as phase one of the project. After Measure R was passed, SIMS still had not moved forward at that point. We had done a needs analysis only. It became obvious at that time that the need for the system was greater than just for the contract administrators. And so phase two was then proposed to extend the system to the entire agency so that the project managers could use it to write their scopes of work, they could monitor the acquisition schedule, and we could generate productivity reports, et cetera. That became phase two of the project, and that was also approved by the board in the capital program. So with this report, we are asking to combine phase one and phase two into one single capital project. The contract activity proceeded with the FY12 budget. Actually, prior to June, we began to write our scope of work and to get our RFP out. We received five proposals, two of which scored high enough during the evaluation process to be considered qualified to perform the work. The request for the life of project budget increase is the result of the competitive RFP process. Although we have recommended the lowest priced technically qualified proposer, the price exceeded our independent cost estimate by nearly $2 million. The independent cost estimate was prepared by our in-house construction estimators who did not anticipate the advanced level of expertise required by the consultants to ensure successful implementation in the MTA environment. Just to give you a benchmark, in recent years we have completed several projects that, although not necessarily enterprise-wide, which means touching every the potential to touch every desk in the agency, they have reached far parts of the agency. An example of that is our HASTIS, or what we used to call TOAST, if you recall that project. That's the operator payroll system. That project cost $7.8 million, which is the same price as approximately as the SIMS project. We currently have an upgrade of our radio system for $8 million. And recently did a SCADA upgrade, an upgrade also to the rail SCADA system, which was also approximately $8 million. So Director Wilson spoke to me before the meeting and said, this seems like so much money for an IT-type project, but it is in the marketplace for similar type projects. And as I said, we did do a competition. We are recommending award to the lowest price, and from the original proposed price, we did a best and final offer, which lowered the price, as well as then we negotiated further with the contractors. So that concludes my presentation.
Mr. Fasano.
Yes, a couple things. First of all, I'm not real thrilled with paper systems, so my inclination is certainly to approve this. I think it's a step forward. I'm also still thinking back. I had to think for a while about the M3 and some other systems we've built and all the excitement we've had watching those projects try and come online and the difficulties. So I guess what I'm kind of wondering is, and I don't know whether this should have started, but before we really go any further with this, I know we need to do it, but have we looked at how these systems are going to be able to talk with each other? I see the information about being off the shelf, which sounds good, but can our various systems talk with each other? And have we really gone over the lessons learned from M3 and some of our other systems before we proceed ahead? I'm saying this conceptually wanting to approve this, but I also know that, you know, actually the cost doesn't seem that high, but it seems like it could also go a lot higher with a whole bunch of change orders and modules and issues that are identified. So
it doesn't happen around here.
If I may. Yes. In fact, that's a very good comment, Director Fasana. One of the reasons why the independent cost estimate is different than the what the final proposed is, we've included on page 9 of the board report, you can see we have 3,244 hours in for database administration. And that was not included in the independent cost estimate that our estimators did. That is integrating, and then also we have 12,000 hours for implementation and integration, labor hours. So what that is making sure that this off-the-shelf system can talk to our FIS system, which is, of course, our main financial information system that we use at this agency. We do have a dedicated project manager working on this project, and then part-time of a lot of other procurement staff to make sure that it lines up with all of our procurement requirements, all of our laws, as well as a contract administrator to help us.
Yeah, I'd welcome in the next month or so seeing a presentation on the lessons learned. Again, I'm inclined to approve this. We can't live in the paper world as our procurements become more complex. But I think we do need to see as a board that there has been an effort to really learn from our past systems work. So I'm willing to move it and just place a motion on the floor with that.
Here's a motion and here's a second.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Ms. Caldwell, Mr. Fasano has been around here a lot longer than I have, and I think he's seen how this system works, how our system works, and with me, as I am in agreement with him on this, the fact that we need to go more paperless. Has anyone talked or thought through in your report, and I don't quite see it here, what savings we could achieve if we go this direction? Are we basically talking about more electronic and less paper?
The answer is yes. We are definitely going to have less paper. Mm-hmm. Did we do a
analysis?
Cost-benefit analysis?
Mm.
No, I don't believe. Oh, did a consultant came on and helped us do a needs requirement prior to my coming into the project. But I have not seen dollars that said, if you implement this system, you are going to save $100 a day. Okay. What we are going to do is be more efficient. And what I'm really hoping to get out of it is I don't have a way right now to measure. There are many, we do many different types of procurements. And I have asked many times, how many days does it take you to do this type of procurement? How many days to do this one? How many days to do that one? Until I know how long it takes to do something, I can't figure out how to improve it. I am so excited with the thought of being able to get, when this system is in, I'll know when they first touch the procurement until they last touch it. I'm going to have key performance indicators that we do not have today. I have to believe that being more efficient will save us money.
Agree with you. Did you want to say something, Mr. Hughes?
Sure.
Yeah, let me just say this.
I think
we need to go the way of more technology, less old-style paper. It's better for the environment. It certainly will reduce costs. I know in my business we've gone 90% paperless in my business, and I'm in a paper-driven business. And so here's what I'm going to ask that we do, and I'm going to ask my colleagues. I don't have a problem with either one of these vendors that you are recommending. I don't know who they are, but what I'm concerned with is that we embark on this without taking into account some of what Mr. Fasano has said and what I've seen around here, too, and that is not having it well thought out, making sure that what we're doing is going to integrate with what we already have and not have a bunch of downtime there. So is there any damage that would be done if we delayed this for 1 month, have you come back and give us the cost-benefit analysis, how much paper will we save, how much ink, and any other thing. Mr. Fasana?
Just, you know, beyond paper and ink, one of the real benefits I think you have here is management tools to tell how long it's taking for procurement to get through, where are the bottlenecks in your system. So I think the information to manage the system, I'm hoping out of this system, would expect would be a lot better than looking at piles of paper and having people to go through them manually to try and figure out how the process is working, where the holdups are. So I would hope that would be in the explanation as well in terms of, you know, not only just the paper and the savings there, but the management tools that you will have to really improve our ability to elect contracts and to manage them.
Mr. Fasano, I think you make some excellent points there. One of the challenges that I see this as our agency has experienced over time is that when we have procurements and we have other things that we do, and ultimately it delays us on moving forward on the timelines that we want to, because things get bogged down for whatever reason. And so going to a better system that we can identify clearly how much time it's going to take, how many hours we need to dedicate for this or that, I think it's going to make us all more happy. And my question to you, again, Ms. Caldwell, is that if we delay this for 1 month and have you come back, I know you're smiling. Smile out loud. If we delay this for 1 month, is that going to cause irreparable damage to us?
Of course not.
Well, the answer to that question is always no.
Of course not. That's right. The board reports for March are due tomorrow, however, and so the chances of me being able to, I believe that I could prepare a lessons learned paper by Friday, as was first requested by Director Fasana, and I certainly intuitively know what kinds of things we will be able to do differently with the SIMS than what we are doing today.
Sure.
I don't know that I could turn it into dollars for you by March.
Okay. Who sets the board report deadlines?
It's driven by the reviews, which are done through a series of meetings during the course of the month, driven primarily by the board cycle and the requirements of the staff to the board.
So who sets those guidelines?
Yeah, it's fundamentally a function of the board.
We set them?
Yeah, well, fundamentally, because there's a series of reviews and steps that are in there which are embedded in the process. It is a lengthy process here, more lengthy than other organizations I've seen. I was going to offer a suggestion.
Go ahead.
Which is that we come back in March with the same board report, but that independent from that, we'll prepare a supplemental document for this committee which will address the issues that you've raised, which we will make available to you.
Mr. Fasano, he has some issues too.
Yes. That way we'll give it to you some weeks before the next committee meeting, so you'll have it in plenty of time to digest it.
I'm fine with that. I think the main thing, again, is lessons learned and the benefits to the management of
I believe I can do those satisfactorily.
Mr. Notarian, you okay?
I'm okay.
Okay, so we'll just have a friendly amendment, and you'll come back at the March meeting with the supplemental report, lessons learned. And you said you could not give us the cost-benefit?
Well, we will, with a little more time that we've described here, we'll do the best we can to keep this moving.
And we do have to work with the proposers as well to extend their bids, but I believe that should not be a problem as well. But I will get back to you if it is.
Okay. All right. Is there any other discussion on this item? Without objection, so ordered. Thank you, Ms. Caldwell. Next item, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Greg Kildare, the Executive Officer of Risk Management. And item 17 before you is an MOU that facilitated a three-party agreement between the Alameda Corridor East, the City of San Gabriel, and Union Pacific Railroad regarding a construction operation and maintenance agreement for the city's improvements that are being constructed as part of the ACE project. That includes a 2.25-mile-long trench and four bridges as part of grade separation project. The proposed MOU before you has two parties, the city and MTA, and it substantially reduces the cost of ensuring the city improvements and adequately compensates MTA for the expected costs of our participation in the MOU. The provisions of the MOU really don't take effect until the spring of 2016, but the three main provisions of the MOU are as follows. The MTA will include the city improvements in our annual property insurance renewal, and the city would then pay the premium for such inclusion. The second provision is the city is going to pay the MTA an annual administrative processing fee of $10,000 to compensate us for the brokerage services, actuarial services, and other services that have been necessary to support the MOU. And then finally, in exchange for receiving an earthquake fee, initially estimated at $23,500 from the city, the MTA will reimburse the city for bona fide earthquake damage to the city improvements up to $5 million per event, provided the city first spends $250,000 in repair costs. If the earthquake event causing the damage to the city improvements is declared either a federal or state disaster area, the MTA shall have no obligation to reimburse the city whatsoever. In addition, the MOU that's before you has extremely liberal cancellation provisions for the MTA. So that concludes my presentation, and I'm able to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Mr. Fasano.
Yeah, I just want to thank staff's efforts for working with the city on this, and it'll be an extremely valuable project. I'm willing to move approval of the MOU.
Good move.
Second.
Second it. I don't have any comments. Any comments, board members? Okay. Without objection, so ordered. Thank you.
Item 18 is a recommendation to appoint Can-Am Enterprises as our financial advisor for the EB-5 program. EB-5 is a provision under the federal law that allows potential immigrants to move ahead in the visa queue by committing to loan $500,000 per person to create jobs in the United States. The EB-5 program has been a matter of federal law since the late 80s, and even though it has continually had sunset provision, they've been routinely renewed, and the current expiration date is this year in 2012. A report was prepared last month, and there were questions raised by this committee, and we added Attachment B to address the questions that we had and to clarify them. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have now.
I have a couple questions. Board members, you have questions? Why are we doing this?
It is a program that could provide low-cost financing and favorable terms for certain kinds of projects or certain kinds of financings.
What does that mean?
It's an additional tool in our financial toolbox.
To do what, though?
To facilitate project development. Implementation, precisely.
You know, maybe I'm just missing it.
It's a low-cost loan program.
This is a low-cost loan for someone who wants to buy real estate, right?
Can buy real estate, but it would be better to, because you have to create jobs, there is more likely construction involved.
And where does the money come from? Does it come from us for the loan?
The potential immigrant will provide the principal values, principal amounts, $500,000 per person. The recommended proposer will aggregate enough $500,000 units to meet an amount of a loan that we would be looking at, which we estimate to be between $10 and $200 million. These are short-term loans for 1.5%.
You know, I don't mean to be dense. I'm just trying to, can you kind of conceptually go through it again, what this does, where the money comes from, who benefits from it?
Okay. We would identify a project that we believe meets the federal criteria of creating sufficient jobs, and further there's a requirement that those jobs be created from high unemployment areas. The arranger will then go out overseas, accumulate the money, get those people processed through a vetting process through the federal government, get our project vetted through the federal government, and provide a loan to us in the amount of, let's call it, $10 million.
So essentially, we would be a conduit for folks who are overseas. They would loan their money to someone who is an immigrant. That immigrant would come here.
Immigrant would put up the money.
The immigrant would put up their own money?
Yes.
What are we doing? What part are we playing?
We are just a borrower.
I'm sorry.
Let me give it a crack, Mr. Matsumoto, since I delayed this. No, I didn't propose it. It's difficult to get green cards, typically.
Right.
This is a vehicle that the government, U.S. government, has proposed that would issue green cards to those foreign investors that are willing to invest money in the United States and create
jobs.
10 jobs for every $500,000 of the investment in return for a green card to that rich investor. It works for the MTA because we need the money, and our projects are very labor-intensive, that we can create those 10 jobs per $500,000 that's invested. And the added benefit is that our interest rate that we're paying is low,
1.5,
relatively low, and we would...
Where does the principal go? I mean, is it like a revolving loan fund? Does it go to the feds? Where does it...
The interest, I mean, the principal would come to us. We would be spending that on our project, and then it would be repaid at a later date back to the investors.
And is it reloaned, or is it?
No, it goes back to the respective investor at the end of the repayment period.
So the person who wants the green car puts the money up, and eventually they get the...
their principal back.
Without interest?
I understand that under Can-Am's proposal, the investors would get 0.25 per year.
Well, Can-Am skims a little bit, for lack of a better word, of the interest. They pay a little bit to the investor, but the investor really doesn't care about what he's returning. He cares about his green card.
Yeah.
I got my green card, hallelujah. I get 0.25 on my money. That's added bonus.
I think this is really creative of our staff. I admire them for bringing this to us and looking for all different ways to get us project funds. At the same time, I don't see a good outcome with the public longer term in terms of this particular program. And given the environment at the federal level, I'm not sure how long it'll be in place. So I'm going to move that we receive and file the report.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved to receive and file. You know, I know the federal government has a policy where if an investor wants to come over and they invest $1 million, they create 10 jobs, and they get at the front of the line in terms of the immigration. So I know that's a policy already in place. Is this a part of that same policy?
Yes.
Okay. You know, I think it's very creative. As Mr. Fasano has said, I think it could get us into some trouble with the perception. You know, we have Measure R, we have other public ways that we're trying to finance, and I don't want to get a bunch of people angry at us that somebody's jumping in front of them from another country, and even though, you know, it's their money, then when we become the conduit of it, I just think it's laced with some opportunities for us to take a lot of negative hits. And I love the idea of coming up with money that that we can get to finance projects, but can you come back with a different idea?
I do want to say that this funding mechanism loan vehicle has been used successfully in several projects as identified by our sister agency, SEPTA, in Philadelphia, Philadelphia Convention Center Authority, Temple University, other fairly well-known names across the country, and there have been any number of smaller examples locally within L.A. County before, and I believe that there's at least one current development being assisted
well,
by.
Again, I think it's very creative, as my colleague has said. Maybe I just didn't get it. I didn't figure it out good enough. But the motion is to receive and file, and maybe you can come back and brief us later and bring it back. But right now, I think that we're just going to put it in the file. Is there any objection to that? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Matsuno.
Good afternoon, directors. Ruth Holden, chief auditor for the agency. And item 19 is second quarter report for the management audit services. We completed 12 projects this quarter and closed 22 open audit recommendations. I've issued 3 internal audit reports this year, or this quarter, I'm sorry. And the first of those is a security sensitive item that hopefully I'll be discussing in next week in closed session. I did a performance audit on the advanced transportation management system. We've been focusing on IT systems throughout the agency to make sure that they have adequate controls and that they do what management wants them to do. And so the ATMS audit showed we had repeat audit findings on based on inadequate access and poor password management. And we also had some physical security issues related to the bus incident recordings and where they're being stored. This audit, we recommended the CEO review whether the placement of the ATMS systems administration within the agency is appropriate and to ensure a secure system and that agency goals are met. Management's currently working on resolving those issues. The other one that we issued is the elevator escalator. It's a performance audit on their contract, and we found things were pretty good. However, the contractor was not complying with the contract provision to submit preventative maintenance and inspection reports. And so management agreed with that and has worked with the contractor so that they are submitting that. The last thing I wanted to talk about is at a prior finance budget and audit committee, committee had requested an update on the status of corrective actions related to the hearing conservation program audit, and we validated that the corrective actions have in fact been implemented in the agency and that they mitigated the risks that were identified during the audit. The last thing I wanted to leave you with is the discussion on the SIMS procurement system. Earlier, we actually have an auditor. We're doing a systems development lifecycle audit as the system is being rolled out to ensure that the appropriate internal controls are in place and that the lessons learned from prior implementations are, in fact, implemented and reviewed during the SIMS rollout. If you have any questions for me, that concludes my report.
Board members, any questions? Okay, thank you, Ms. Holden.
Thank you.
CEO.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to note for you that we had two developments as regards the connector, the regional connector, and the subway. The President's budget included $81 million combined for the two projects. This marks the first time that there's been a specific indication of federal funding for the projects. In addition to that, yesterday the Federal Transit Administration issued their annual New Starts report, and I'm pleased to say included both those projects in the report. We will continue to work with the FTA to get records of decisions and to move into a full funding grant agreement next year, but this was a step in that direction towards getting the projects done. And with that, I will conclude. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. CEO. Mr. CEO, I just whispered to one of my colleagues. I think it would be appropriate for this committee to have on a monthly basis when we meet a report from your legislative team. I noticed that a couple weeks ago that the Federal Aviation Administration finally passed a bill, and I believe the President signed off on that bill. And that's actually kind of a rare thing in the last year cycle of legislative work in D.C. that something's happened. And there's a likelihood that there may be some breakthrough with the transportation bill that we've been waiting for quite some time. So I'd like to have your legislative team come and give us a report for the next number of meetings that we have here on what's going on there, so that we can get a better sense of where our money's coming from and what we need to do. On the report that Mr. Masumoto's team gave, I think he mentioned that there was some discussion with the folks at DOT on the TIFI along, specifically as it relates to the Crenshaw line. So these things have to do with dollars that we're going to get. So can you have your team come? I'm not asking for them to come today. I'm just saying from this point on, if you could have them be a part of the deliberations that we have and give a report as the auditor does and so forth.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Is there any member of the public that would like to speak that didn't bring their card up there? Ms. Moody, did you want to say anything? Okay. Is there anyone in the audience? If not, meeting adjourned. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Okay, so Brad, do you see how that was done just now?
Just like that?
Just like that. That was well done.
It's a real challenge, Director Katz. Thank you.
Appreciate it, Brad.
Item 11 was a motion that was brought to the board committee last month, which would allow the Measure R Highway subfunds to be used as a local match for the call. You'd asked for clarification on some of the issues regarding this, and we have attached a board box to provide you some information. And just in summary, the Measure R Highway subfund is a separate category from the local return Measure R funding. It was specifically identified in Measure R and goes to several COGs, including Arroyo Verdugo, Las Virgenes Malibu, South Bay, and Gateway for some specific projects such as the 605 hotspots and grade separations. And so just as in your attachment, we've identified the eligibility criteria, so basic road type improvements such as interchanges, ramp modifications, intersections, street widenings. We've also, three of the COGs have brought their Measure R highway subfund list to the board, and they've been approved. And so you have the list of those three: COGS, Arroyo Verdugo, Las Virgenes Malibu, and South Bay. And you can kind of see that they're arterial-related projects. And the Gateway COG is still considering the projects that they'll be bringing forward. So they're in that process. And as far as the policy goes, it is within the board's discretion to allow the measure, the subfunds to be used for local match. There aren't really any impediments to that. This is kind of a new issue, being that Measure R is new, and so there hasn't been any prior board direction on this issue. So really, as long as a project is both eligible for the Measure R highway subfund and eligible to compete in the call, the board could choose to adopt this policy. And of course, in order for this to work, a project would have to successfully compete through the competitive process of the call. So that's my summary. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, comments?
Moved
and seconded. Any objections? So ordered. Thank you. Item number 13, regional rail update. Need to talk fast because we're going to get kicked out of here by the next committee.
Very fast. Actually, I'll even forego most of the PowerPoint presentation if that is to your pleasure. Okay. Real quickly, I'm just going to pick up a couple of highlights that we're working on regional rail. The LOSAN board, the LOSAN governance issue, as you know, we're moving forward with local governance of the Amtrak Pacific Surfliner service. A spot bill will be introduced for legislation later this month. We're working on authors for that, and the overall documents are in progress, including we're reviewing a draft business plan on that item right now. The advanced investment MOU that the board approved last month with California High Speed Rail is moving forward very quickly. It's still a dynamic process. We're still herding the cats on this one, but it's looking good on this, and we'll have more to come in the coming months. The Antelope Valley Line study is in draft report format. We are looking at it right now. We will be providing a series of myriad of comments on this report as it comes forward. I tend to go back to my professor days. And we'll be reporting that as a separate board item next month to this committee, with some recommendations concerning some specific concerns that have popped up during the process of this study and also working on this MOU. And that being said, I've caught the high points. If there's
Thank
any
you.
Questions.
If there are no questions and if no objections, we'll receive and file. Thank you very much for being so efficient today. Item number 51.
Yes, Madam Chair. Item 51 is the third and the final of the utility relocation studies to be conducted as part of the I-710 South Corridor. The recommendation is to authorize the CEO to execute a contract and modification authority with Mark Thomas and Company for much more detailed utility studies as a part of the central segment of I-710 corridor, more so than we normally do in an environmental document phase. This is our most complex segment. It's where all the big Edison lines, this is what creates the opportunity for that project to become real. Much like the other two that we've already approved, it's proven to be very significant to get in advance and do quite a bit of utility work while the environmental document is still ongoing.
Any questions?
Second.
Moved and seconded. No objections. So ordered. And ladies and gentlemen, I believe that we don't have any more public comment, do we? Just general public comment? I believe that concludes our meeting. Thank you very much for your assistance and patience. Thank you.